Have you ever been to the Sundance Film Festival? I went just once. I drove up to Park City to cover an acoustic performance by Sting for the Salt Lake Tribune. It was snowing, and everyone was waiting for a shuttle bus that they hoped would take them to the right place at the right time. There were cinephiles chattering about the indie films they were excited to see, out-of-town folks decked out in faux fur heading to parties, and, at one point, I turned around and there stood Danny DeVito, my first brush with fame. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means, and today we viewed the Sundance Film Festival through the eyes of a critic and a filmmaker. The festival runs January 18th through 28th this year, with screenings in Park City, Salt Lake City, and at the Sundance Mountain Resort. I'm certainly no Sundance veteran, so I talked with someone who knows the ins and outs of the whole scene, Sean P. Means, movie critic at the Salt Lake Tribune, who has been covering the festival for 25 years.
My name is Sean Means. I'm the movie critic for the Salt Lake Tribune, and I have been doing that for nearly 25 years.
25 years, Sean?
Mm-hmm.
I've been alive for 25 years.
We've had this discussion.
You have Sundance swag older than me, I believe.
I have a Sundance sweatshirt that is older than you, yes.
I like that story. But like you pointed out, you've been doing this for 25 years.
Yes.
Which is a long time to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I want you to reflect back on the first Sundance you ever covered. That would be in 1993?
94.
Okay. And what was it like for you to cover Sundance for the first time?
It was very exciting. It was very... I had been a couple years before that when my predecessor, Terry Orme, was the movie critic. And so I had gotten a feel for the crowds and the lines and the excitement of seeing a new movie and seeing something that you know may not see ever again or never seen anything like it before.
Was it cold?
It's always cold. The tradition is that Sundance brings the snow, that the festival, you know, wills the snow to land. And last year, of course, it was just a monster. It's cold, but there's this great spirit of camaraderie. I mean, if you're in the lines waiting for films, or if you're on the buses, you know, there's a lot of conversation, a lot of talk. You find out what are the interesting movies. You find out what people liked and didn't like. You get the real skinny. You get the real buzz of what's interesting and what's exciting. You find out stories about celebrities. You sometimes run into celebrities on the shuttle buses who like to go incognito.
I'm glad you brought that up. Did you get starstruck your first year?
My first year. A little bit. The first year I went in 92, I got starstruck by this veteran character actor named Seymour Cassell, who was in John Cassavetes movies in the 70s and so on. And he was in the movie that won the grand jury that year called In the Soup, which was he played a gangster who befriends this young screenwriter who wants to make his movie, played by Steve Buscemi. And it also had Jennifer Beals in it. And I went to the final day of the festival when they show the award winners, and I actually went up and shook his hand afterwards, and it was very accessible. It was much more accessible back in the sort of old Wild West days than maybe it is now. Now the celebrities are very sort of told where to go and what to do and all that to a much larger degree than they were then.
They're not allowed to roam freely anymore.
They sometimes will, but you sort of have to watch your spots. I've had some years. One year I was up on the upper end of Main Street one morning meeting somebody. And I saw, walking out of his hotel and taking his morning constitutional on Main Street, I saw Sam Shepard just walking alone, nobody bugging him, looking like the rugged Western icon that he was, and just, you know, having his morning walk, right? One morning on a shuttle bus, I got talking with a woman, and I recognized her, and I realized, like, almost instantly as I was talking to her that it was Faye Dunaway.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And she didn't even have a movie there. She's just there. I mean, she's friends with Redford, with our Redford back from, you know, 3 days of the Condor and so on. But she just likes to go and likes to just do her thing and enjoy the festival and sort of be one of the people.
As a critic, Sean has to pay attention to all the details that make a movie good or bad. The writing, directing, acting, cinematography. But I wondered, does he ever just take the time to sit back and enjoy the show?
Well, the thing is, being in movie critic mode is hopefully enjoying movies. And it depends largely on the movie. I mean, if the movie presents itself as something that's amazing, I'm going to feel that. I mean, people talk about how, critics, they just want to hate it on stuff. It's like, no, critics want to love movies as much, if not more, than anybody. I mean, we've structured our lives around going to movies. We definitely want to see good ones, and we want to like the movies we see. And I'm always open. I mean, when the house lights go down and the film starts, I am open for it. I want the movie to hit me. I want the movie to do its magic on me. And I live in perpetual hope that a movie will, whether it's an indie at Sundance or a big movie, a studio movie or whatever. I'm always hopeful that it's going, what I'm about to see is going to be good, and it's going to be worth the hour and a half, 2 hours of time I'm spending on it, and worth the months and sometimes years it took the people who made it to get it finished. That's the thing. Every single movie at the festival is the story of somebody who was so determined to get the story on the screen that they have sacrificed blood and treasure to make it happen. Whether it was, following a family around for 10 years and capturing their life on film, or an actor who shepherds a project from TV to movie to whatever, because they are so determined to play this character. Every movie is a journey for the people who made it. So a good critic respects that and acknowledges that and sees the work that goes into it. You don't give it a pass just because, these people worked hard on it. I mean, if it turns out that it's terrible, it's like, well, these people worked hard and it turned out to be yuck.
Is that the most disappointing thing? Because you probably don't want to write that review.
Nobody deliberately tries to make a bad movie. Most nobody. There have been attempts to try to make the worst movie of all time.
Are you talking about the Emoji Movie?
The Room. He thought he was. He thought he was making a good movie. I mean, when it got the reaction he got, he changed the story and said, "Oh yeah, I meant to do that," but no, he did not. You respect the attempt, but you're not blinded by it. You do have to ask the question sometimes, okay, was it worth your 2 years, 3 years, whatever, to do this thing that utterly fails on every level? And it's a tough question to ask, but that's what the critics have to ask sometimes.
Movie critics are great at making lists, so I figured Sean probably had one for the best Sundance films he'd ever seen. He did.
It's a running list, but it's a constantly shifting one because, I mean, as with any critic in a top 10 list or whatever, it could depend on mood, how you're feeling that on the day you're writing the list. If you're in a bad mood, all the movies are going to be, sad tales of woe. And if you're in a good mood, it's going to be all, happy love stories and so on.
I asked him to pick his top three.
Top three. Oh, boy. Okay. Beasts of the Southern Wild, 2012, became a Best Picture Oscar nominee. Sort of part realistic, part magical realism look at life in a Louisiana Delta town through the eyes of a 6-year-old. Beautiful, gorgeous movie. When I saw that, when they played the 2-minute clip during the Oscar ceremony, I started to tear up. That's one. Once. 2007 musical, Irish street busker meets a Czech immigrant, and they start to have a relationship through music, through song. Amazing movie. Won the song Falling Slowly won the Oscar for best song that year. Glenn Hansard and Marketa Iriglova, the couple who played the leads, toured with their band the Swell Season on the strength of the songs from that movie. The movie later became a Broadway musical, which won the Tony.
Wow.
Third one. Oh, boy. Probably have to say Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Is that from last year?
That was 2001.
What do I know?
Yeah.
But it was just at the Eccles, wasn't it?
Hedwig and the Angry Inch started as an off-Broadway musical with John Cameron Mitchell playing the lead role, done as a concert, as a rock concert, with Mitchell as the lead character, Hedwig, a transsexual East German rock diva.
That sounds wild.
As she says, the internationally ignored song stylist barely standing before you. Mitchell came to Sundance Labs to develop it into a movie, which he wrote the screenplay, decided to direct it, and also decided that he had to play the lead role. So he was the writer, director, and star of the movie. Beautiful movie version. It took off and became a it was already a sort of a New York phenomenon in its original stage form, became a global phenomenon thanks to the movie. There was a Broadway revival, finally came to Broadway about 3 or 4 years ago with Neil Patrick Harris in the lead. Neil Patrick Harris won the Tony for it. Other people took the role on for when Harris left, including Andrew Rannells and including John Cameron Mitchell came back and did it. He had sort of quit acting, and now the Broadway version has now toured, and the Eccles had it last Christmas, Christmas 16, so about a year ago. But yeah, it is a cathartic, glorious musical, the fact that I saw it in early 2001 and then saw it again in late 2001, and in the interim was the 9/11 attacks, and how the whole notion of how our world changed, you know, when after 9/11, you see that movie and the poignancy of somebody who is split down the middle was sort of everything about that year. It's still a beautiful thing. And every time, if I'm at home channel surfing and I hit on that, if I come across that movie, I will usually stay and watch all the way to the end. So
that's how you know it's a good one.
Exactly.
Sean P. Means, movie critic at the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your stories with me.
Thank you.
I hope you have a successful Sundance
and I hope you
take a vacation.
And tell people, sltrib.com, click, read, share, let people know what we're doing here and read our stuff.
You got it. As viewers, it's our job to sit down and behold what's on the screen in front of us. But what goes on behind the scenes of a Sundance film? Quiet Heroes is a documentary featured at the festival this year about Dr. Kristen Reese and Maggie Snyder, the only medical professionals in Utah who treated HIV/AIDS patients during the AIDS crisis. Here's a clip from the film.
At that time, the LDS Church saw no light with gay people or homosexuality.
We heard from people that if you had HIV/AIDS, you deserved it. There were even doctors who said, hey, I'm not going to put myself and my family at risk because these people engaged in such wrongful conduct.
Salt Lake got AIDS very early, and so it was luck that someone like Kristen Reese had just moved to Salt Lake City.
I spoke with Jenny McKenzie, director of Quiet Heroes, about what it was like to bring this local story to the big screen. Jenny McKenzie, you're a filmmaker here in Salt Lake City. Thank you so much for joining me today. The 2018 Sundance Film Festival is quickly approaching, and your film, Quiet Heroes, is a featured documentary. And this is actually the first time you've had a film featured at Sundance. So how are you feeling? And congratulations.
Thank you so much, Emily. It really is. I mean, it's a dream come true. And we are in the Sundance countdown. So to have a local story be premiering in our own backyard is just incredible. Our entire team is so excited.
You're a local filmmaker. The story you highlighted takes place in Utah in the 80s during the AIDS crisis. So I'm hoping you'll tell us a bit about Dr. Kristen Reese and Maggie Snyder's story and what led you to it.
The story actually came from our executive producer, Jared Ruga, who found out about Kristen and Maggie's work through his law professor, Terry Kogan. And he and I got together. And then we met with Kristen Reese, and he invited me to collaborate with him. We've been working on the story for about 2.5 years. And I think for me, you realize that sometimes our best stories are in our own backyard. And telling these local pieces is really important.
Kristen Reese and Maggie Snyder, they were the only doctors to treat AIDS patients in the Intermountain West. So their story is particularly interesting, I think, because of where we are. We're in Utah, and there's a strong religious LDS culture here, right?
Absolutely. There's a strong religious culture. And in the 1980s, of course, it was even more conservative. And they were the only ones in the early 80s who were treating AIDS patients in this region, in the heartland of the West. And I think their work was particularly unique because they worked hand in hand with the Sisters of the Holy Cross. So this Catholic hospital, Holy Cross Hospital, here in Salt Lake City, was the only place that would open its doors to patients who had AIDS and at that time were dying of AIDS.
And it's definitely an inspirational story, but you talked with Kristen. How was it to reflect back on this time period with her?
Talking with Dr. Reese about their work was inspirational, and we spent hours together and really days. Both she and Maggie are behind the scenes kind of people that I don't think like being front and center. And as physicians, they were ones who used to listen to their patients, not share their own stories. So talking with them and reliving their history was really powerful because I think you really were able to imagine the devastation that they faced. And I think for them to step away from the work after their retirement, because they had been retired for several years when we began the project 2.5 years ago, and for them to step back and think through the stories and talk about the patients and talk about the numbers of patients that they actually lost made it all feel very real. And you understood how tragic some of that work must have been.
Did you get to speak with any survivors from the time, any of Maggie and Kristen's patients?
Absolutely. The film really follows Dr. Reese and Maggie's journey and the work that they did, but we also include 3 of their former patients' stories. And with those stories, we have a lot of their archival family footage as well as photos. So I think those stories give you a more intimate view into the experience of what it was like to live with AIDS, get treated by these incredible physicians, and sadly die from AIDS.
This is a story from 30 years ago, and I imagine a lot of legwork goes into a project like this. Maybe you can talk a bit about the process of revisiting this story and translating it to the audience, you know, in this more modern time.
What a great question. It's to take a historical story like this and make it relevant and contemporary right now can be hard. And this film, I think, is such a beautiful piece because of the collective and creative minds that came together to get it across the finish line. So one of the things that our producers and co-directors were able to do in the second half of post-production, I think, is really refine this story and bring it to the screen in a way that makes it feel more relevant with these beautiful photographs and all of this archival material. But when you think about a hero's journey and the work that Kristen and Maggie did never gets old, because we all want to be reminded of quiet, humble, compassionate, kind, accepting people who, in the face of adversity, did what was needed, which is they stepped up to the plate, they treated men who were dying, they treated men who were being rejected by their families because they didn't fit in to the religious norms, and they were present for their patients in a way that I think that kind of story is timeless.
I was watching the Golden Globes this weekend, and I was thinking about how it was the perfect time for some of these films to be released. So, for instance, Darkest Hour, the Winston Churchill film, came out in a time when there's a big discussion about world leadership, or Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, about a mother who takes action after the rape and murder of her daughter goes unpunished. That came out while activists are taking this huge stand against gender inequality and sexual misconduct. So I'm wondering why this was the right time to tell Kristen and Maggie's story, and if you intended for it to mirror anything that's happening in our current social and political climate.
Absolutely, it's timely for this story to premiere and be out in the world, because LGBT rights are really in jeopardy right now. Healthcare is in jeopardy, and especially healthcare for those who are socioeconomically challenged. And that's one of the things that was so heroic about Kristen, Maggie, and the Sisters of the Holy Cross, is that it didn't matter what your financial means were. They opened their doors and they treated you. And so I think it is good timing for this story to get out in the world. And Sundance is profiling several films with women who are in their 70s and above. They also have a film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They have a film about Jane Fonda. So I think our story about Dr. Kristen Reese fits in well with some of the other pieces they're programming.
We talked about how this is going back in history a bit. Do you see anything reflected in that story and in that place, in Utah, reflected in the activism or the policies made here in Utah now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we continue to see history repeating itself, and I think we continue to see legislature issues that are exclusionary rather than inclusionary. And we still are fighting the same battles in not just the Mormon religion, but other conservative religions as well. So those historical pieces around acceptance and inclusion and fairly treating all people still exist and continue to recur.
I was kind of looking back to see some of your other work, and you've created films ranging in topics from diabetes to opioid addiction to an undefeated third grade girls soccer team. These are all very different subjects. How do you find the story you want to tell within these topics, and also the best way to tell it?
Well, I think for me, a story has to resonate with me personally. So it has to be connected to something that I care about. And overall, I love telling social justice pieces, public health stories. And this film, when Jared found it and approached me with the story, really resonated, because I grew up in New York City in the 70s and 80s with two parents who were in the theater profession. So I saw the devastation of AIDS in the early 80s, and they had friends and colleagues who were suffering from the disease. But I think if a story personally resonates with you, you will bring a unique point of view and a different passion to that film and that story. And I think that's true for our entire team, but especially my producer, who is a 29-year-old openly gay man. And I think for him, he wanted to pay tribute to the people who made a difference for the LGBT community 30 years ago.
It seems like you're an activist as well as a filmmaker. I don't know if you would agree with
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm wondering what issues you're keeping tabs on, and if you're chasing a story for a future documentary.
I definitely consider myself a social activist, and I was a social worker for 15 years prior to making in the system prior to making documentaries. So I think for me, social impact and telling these stories so that we can create change is what's very important. I'm making a multi-part documentary series right now about breast cancer in America. And we're chasing three separate stories, but really looking at the women who are living with the disease, the women who are dying from the disease, and the researchers and the clinicians who are treating the disease. And for me, breast cancer, another public health story, became interesting because it was personal. I lost an aunt to breast cancer and a very, very close friend. But also, I began looking at the data and looking at the research on the 30 years of corporate pinking and what we've been doing, you know, with pink NFLs, pink lemonade on Delta flights, and all of this different fundraising that has increased awareness and education, but we're not seeing a decrease in mortality rates. So, as you mentioned, social impact is deeply meaningful to me because of my social work roots. And I feel so excited being able to tell stories that get into communities and hopefully are a tool to create conversation and change.
Will you be focusing on any Utah-specific stories again in the future?
Absolutely. The breast cancer piece that we're focusing on, called However Long, one of the episodes takes place at the Huntsman Cancer Institute.
Well, Jenny McKenzie, thank you so much for joining me. Congratulations on your Sundance entry, and best of luck to you. We're excited to see what's coming down the line.
Thank you so much, Emily. We're excited too.
Are you an avid Sundance goer? What's the best or worst experience you've had at the festival? Tell us at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can hear all of the In the Hive podcasts at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.